Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Doreen from York.
Hi, everyone. My name is Doreen Lear, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Dave for asking us to come up, I think. I'm not very good on directions. That's why I have a GPS. That's why I have a sponsor, too. Thank the group for inviting us to come up tonight. And I was sitting there thinking, where's the hot flashes when I need them? It's just like, I'm used to the hot flashes, and when I need them, they don't come. I could use one right now. But it's always a pleasure. It's always a gift to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope about what God and the 12 steps and sponsorship has done in my life. And that's where I give the credit to God. But without God, there would be no steps and there would be no sponsorship. So what I can do is just the best to stick to my story. You know, if I have an opinion, I'll say, well, that's my opinion. And that probably doesn't hold much water, but it's definitely my opinion. My sobriety date is August 9th of 98. I belong to the Roosevelt 12 and 12 group. It meets in York, Pennsylvania on 5101 Darlington Road. If you're ever in the area, please do come. It's a Step in Traditions meeting. And we uphold the steps and the traditions in that meeting. You know, I have a job in that group. Right now I'm the door greeter because they just changed jobs and I didn't get a specific job. But I figure if I don't have a job, my sponsor always told me to stand at the door and greet the people. Because that's what they did when I came here. You know, we had my first home group when I first got sober was Harbor City Speakers Group, and I'm pretty sure a lot of you know that name. You know, we're not special or anything, but we uphold the steps and tradition in that group. So we kind of took those standards and applied them to the group that we have today. Actually, the group 12, Roosevelt 12 and 12 started out in my husband and I's basement because we felt there was a need for steps and tradition in York, Pennsylvania. Because sometimes, you know, God just moves you in a way that when there's a need, you can't deny when God wants you to move it, you know. So we moved it in our basement. It started taking off. We started that group in 2008, and now we're in the church. It started out maybe 20 people in our basement, and it moved to like 40 people, and then it was like 60 people, and they were hanging out on our steps going up to the door. And we were like, you know, we decided, well, we better start looking for a church because pretty soon we're going to have it out on our lawn because that's about how big it was getting. So you can always tell when a group starts meeting whether there is a need, because now we probably have at least 50, 60, 70 people each Wednesday. So there was a need. And, you know, we never know why we do what we do, but when God inspires you to do something, you better follow it. That's what I've learned. Sometimes my mind's like, oh, I don't really like doing that. My heart's like, well, you better do it anyway. And I think that's what keeps me sober and gives me the grace and respect that I have for Alcoholics Anonymous today. Okay, so now that all that's out of the way. I was born and raised in South Baltimore, right down around near the Inner Harbor area, and that's why Harbor City Speakers Group was my first meeting, my first home group, actually, that I joined. I was born and raised in an alcoholic home. My father was the alcoholic, and he was the type of alcoholic that, you know, as soon as his hand hit the doorknob, we didn't know if he was going to be restless, irritable, discontent, or if he was going to be happy, joyous, or free. So we waited for him to come in. And pretty much my whole childhood was based upon how my father acted, you know, because when he came in the door and we knew he was, you know, he was the type of alcoholic that liked to throw things, and we got used to moving quick, and, you know, our reflux were very well, you know, he developed that reflux very soon, early on in our childhood, so we learned how to move our head real quick when a mayonnaise jar would fly past it or something, you know, and that was normal to me. I did not know that there wasn't people that didn't drink, you know. And I'm the youngest of eight, and I have a brother who has 17 years in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I watched the way that brother drank, and I drank nothing like him. So I was thinking to myself, I can't be an alcoholic because I don't drink like him. I didn't do some of the things that he had done. See, because I based my alcoholism, or what I thought alcoholism was, was what people did on the outside. So when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on August 9, 1998, I like to say I came from my living room, because I've never been in any detoxes, I've never had any rehabs, I've never been medicated by any doctors, I've never been locked up in any type of institutions, I've never had any DUIs, never lost anything. So here's my thinking, alcoholism, you know, at its best. Well, I can't be an alcoholic because I never lost all that stuff, or I never did this, I never, you know, all those nevers that people, you know, share from the podium. Well, my alcoholic thinking is, well, I can't be an alcoholic because I didn't do that. Whew, boy, was I an alcoholic. Once I came to the reality of what an alcoholic was, you know, and I saw that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to say, you know, I got convinced in the rooms. But I'll share a little bit about my drunkenness. I used to have this sister who loved to drink. Oh, God, I wanted to be just like her. I wanted to drink just like her. But I was very small and petite back then, you know, in my teens. And, you know, and I couldn't keep up with her physically. You know, the booze just wouldn't, my body just wouldn't allow the booze to stay there, you know, stay in there. And so I was a puker, you know. And I remember it was just so amazing. I mean, it was like, you know how when you're a child, you know, people always say, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I had some ideas of what I wanted to be. I liked nursing, you know, and eventually I did get into the medical field, but that was not my goal once I started drinking. My goal when I started drinking was, man, I can't wait till I turn 18 so I can drink in the bar and drink the way I want to drink, you know, because when you're 14, 16, 17, you can't drink the way you want to drink because you're not of legal age. Well, the drinking age back when I, you know, turned 18 was 18, and you could only drink beer and wine. You couldn't have hard liquor, which I was never a hard liquor drinker anyway, so I figured, well, hell, now I can drink the way I want to drink. And so that was one of my aspirations, you know. I can't wait till I turn 18 so I can get to the bar and drink like I want to drink. I should have had a clue back then, you know, like that was my goal in life. I wanted to drink just like that sister. Now, she was the bar brawler, and I wasn't. You know, I was pretty much, when the fight broke out, I would just take my drink and run off to the corner because, you know, I always said, you know, when I got here, I had so much pain that if I could just hit somebody and get away with it, I would be happy. But people hit back, you know. It's like, so I never really got in any fights because even though I wanted to hit them, I knew I would get hit back. See, I had some sanity there, a little, you know, kept me out of a lot of fights. But, you know, this sister, she loved to hit people. She didn't have a problem with it. And all her anger was vented up toward men, and she was the bar brawler. I mean, I would watch her, like, smash mugs, you know, those frosted mugs full, you know, in the bar. You get the draft beers in those big frosted mugs, and she would smash them over guys' heads. And I saw her one time, she picked up a bar stool and hit this guy across the head with it. And you know, she's a little broader than I am. And she's the same height, but a little broader than me. And she worked in a bar, so, you know, she had the muscles because she used to pack the, you know, coolers at night with all the cases of beer. So she built up some muscles, and she could hit them men, and she could defend herself. And I was the little tiny one, like, behind her back, and I was like, yeah, go get them. And then I'd run over to go, you know, I was like, yeah, at least she could hit them. I wanted to hit them, I swear. I had a desire to hit people when I was out there, but I didn't. I had a lot of desires when I was out there. I had a desire not to sleep with people, but that didn't stop me from sleeping with them. So I had the only requirement for Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had a lot of other desires when I got here, you know. And I'll share a little bit of that, and I won't go into my fifth step, but when I was home, I was married. When I was in the bar, I was single. And it's hard being single in the bar when your husband's with you. Oh, that's painful. Oh. Especially when that good-looking guy over there is paying attention to me, and I'm looking at him, and I'm looking at him, and I'm like, but he ain't paying attention to me. He's paying attention to me. And I had to start a fight with him so I could be with him. That's painful. Thank God I don't have to do that today. Thank God. There is sanity. It does return. And I think that has everything to do because I was uncomfortable in my own skin. I really didn't want to be the person that I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did not know how not to be that person. I was brought up with respect and morals, and like the book says, I had the philosophical and morals. You know, my parents instilled good nature in me. But because of this disease that's called alcoholism that I didn't realize was the selfishness and self-centeredness, it was all about me, you know. So by the time I was out of high school, you know, like I said, I wanted to be like that sister. So I was right out of high school into a marriage. I like to say that the gynecologist made that decision for me because I was about... I went to go get birth control pills, and I found out I was 2 weeks pregnant. So, you know, the old school way, and this is how our parents, you know, instilled in me that you don't have a child out of wedlock. So, you know, we got married, and I like to say the gynecologist made that decision because I found out I was pregnant. I mean, him and I fought all the time, even when we were dating. That should have gave us a clue. You know, I mean, remember, he used to drag me across bar stools, and he's like, if you're not ready to go when I'm ready to go, you find your own way home. Well, there's part of my fifth step. I found my way home. Sometimes it wasn't my home, but it was home for the night. God, she was sick. I'm telling you, she was sick. So out of the high school into the marriage, and had 3 kids by the time I was 24. And I drank as often as I could for what the money would allow me to, you know, because I wanted to be the best mother I could be, but I didn't, the skills just weren't there, you know. When you're an alcoholic, the skills just aren't there. You know, I tried to be the best person I could be, but the drink oversaw that, you know. And I didn't know I was in the nature of this, grips of this disease. Like I said, way before I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I tried to deny it for so long. You know, I knew what alcohol would do to an unborn fetus, but that still didn't stop me from drinking. And I can only tell you this in hindsight, because when we're going through it, we can't see it. The book says that we live in this delusion, and that our drink life is the only life we know. So I didn't know. I didn't know. There's one of our old-timers, when I got sober in Maryland, they told us. He used to always say I was double dumb. I didn't know. I didn't know. So I had to stop beating myself up, too. Because I didn't know. And that's a gift. You know, I'd let you off the hook way before I let me off the hook. Because I was my judge, juror, and executioner. And I wanted me dead. And that's pretty much where the end of my drunkenness turned out. You know, like I said, by the time I was 24, I had 3 kids. And I tried to be the best mother I could be, you know. Actually, I was just sharing with one of the girls that I sponsor. I said to her, I said, you know, that I was so in the grips of this this illness that I couldn't see it. You know, I was in the mirrors, you know, the way they call it, that murkiness, that misery. I was living in the misery and the depression, and I didn't know what it was. I thought it was his fault, you know, because I always say, you know, if you had a husband like mine, you'd drink too. You know, it's all their fault. Well, I don't know where they went. When I got sober, they all went away. So it was like, it's not their fault anymore. But I remember my first husband, you know, I did have an affair, and he just kept asking me if I was having an affair, and I tried to be honest and say, you know, I didn't want to tell him I was having an affair because I didn't want to hurt his feelings. But he kept asking, and you know, when they keep asking you the question, you know, I just broke down. I was like, yeah, okay, so yeah, I slept with him, okay, you know. And so he has a sister that works for an attorney. And he said to me, he says, well, I'm going to have my sister draw up this paper. And he had it notarized. And he says, I want you to sign this paper. He says, and if you ever, ever have another affair on me, I'm going to get full custody of our son. And I had one, that was my first son at the time. And in my sincerity, which I never believed I would never have another affair, because how can I give up a child? I mean, what type of mother would do something like that? But in the deepest and the darkness of this disease, I signed that paper, and I had another affair. You don't think this thing is cunning, baffling, and powerful? I'd be willing to sign over the rights to my child so that I can drink. And I didn't even see that had anything to do with alcoholism. You know, and I sincerely didn't think I'd have another one. But I had 2 more after that, so, you know, it's just part of the journey. You know, I may not, you know, I'm not proud of some of the things I've done, and thank God for the 9th step, because I have a new way of life with my children because of that. You know, I've made the amends, and I brought people into my home who physically and mentally abused my children so that I could drink. If I want to get honest with myself, see, we don't want to face the truth because, you know, we're only as sick as our secrets. But I had to face that truth, that the reason I brought this man in my home and one of my children were molested in the process. The reason I brought this man in my home, because I thought I was doing a good deed. He was on the street and he was a family member. So, how, you know, you're supposed to trust your family. But see, sickness runs deeper than alcoholism. And I didn't know this. And I brought this man into my home. And, you know, thank God we found out in enough time. And that he was, you know, he was put in jail for the time for what he had done. And, you know, I came into my sanity at that point. But, you know, trying to face your child and telling them you were wrong for bringing these people into your home who physically and mentally abused them, that's a hard way to go. That's like deep guilt and shame. But thank God for the ninth step, because I no longer carry that guilt and shame. And you can surpass anything when God is involved. That is a gift. So here's the end of my drunkenness. I had fun drinking. Like I said, I couldn't wait till I turned 18 so I could get in the bar and drink just like that sister. Any opportunity I could drink, I drank. I joined pool leagues, bowling leagues. I joined dart leagues. Wasn't very good at that part of the league, but the drinking was good. You know, that's the whole purpose. That's the whole reason I joined those leagues, because it gave me 4 hours of continuous drinking, and he couldn't say nothing to me about it. So, got my drunk on. That's what I did, you know. I never went out to have one or two. I always would say, I'm going out to get my drunk on. Because, you know, I deserved a drink. I took care of this house. I took care of these kids. I worked, you know. I cleaned. I cooked. I deserve a drink. Alcoholism, isn't that funny? You know, normal people don't think they deserve a drink. They just go out on a social occasion, have one or two, and they go home and they become good parents. And they become good, you know, wives and husbands and stuff like that. I don't think normal drinkers question whether they're an alcoholic or not. Might want to take a look at that. So, the end of my drunkenness, this is how I lived. Every day I would go to work not wanting to be on that job. The reason I was, you know, when I'm on that job, I know those people over there, they got to be talking about me because they're amongst themselves and it's got to be about me. And sometimes I would go over there and I'd ask them, who are you talking about? They're like, we're not talking about anybody, Doreen, we're just talking. But I was so wrapped up in the self, I couldn't see it. I was so deep into the self-centeredness that the big book describes that it was always about me. You know, I'd leave that job and I'd go home. And then I'd feel that, you ever get that, like your skin's crawling, and I didn't want to be at that home. And I was like, you know, as soon as I go in that door, you know, the house is going to be a mess, and I just cleaned it, and then I start throwing things. Now, these are all sober things I'm doing, because I wasn't a daily drinker when I got here. It was close to it, but I wasn't a daily drinker yet, you know, and then he would make my skin crawl. Those kids just don't listen anymore, and back and forth to work I'd go. The same thing played over and over. It was like a daily ritual. And every time I would cross this bridge going to and from work, there was this thought that would cross my mind, which is, turn the wheel, Doreen. Just turn the wheel and let that truck go over the bridge and it'll all be over. And I had those thoughts on a daily basis. And even the drink couldn't even take those thoughts away anymore. And I'd grab that steering wheel so hard, because I knew I wanted to turn that steering wheel, but I couldn't. Because here's the next thing, you know, who's going to take care of my kids if I'm gone? Like I was taking, I was a drunk on the sofa. I was really taking care of them, you know, but I was taking care of them. And I remember I'd grab that steering wheel and I'd be so wrapped up in myself that I'd actually visualize the truck going over the bridge and it would crash. And I'd feel this sense of ease and comfort, like, thank God it's over. And then I'd crawl out the window. That's how much power I have over myself that I can't even kill myself in my vision. I mean, God goes deep. God goes real deep. I mean, if he's got a purpose for you, you can't even kill yourself in your vision. I mean, he even gets in there. You know, he's like, no, not yet, Doreen. You're not going to kill yourself, not even in your vision. It's so funny when I look back. It's like hilarious. It's just, that's where I was, you know. So the last drunk that I went out, as usual, two beers in the shower, because, you know, who goes to a bar without drinking? It makes no sense. You know, you got to have a few before you get there. I called it priming. It's alcoholism. We can put whatever name we want on it, but that's what it was back then. I primed myself. You know, I put, you know how like when you put a coat of paint on a car, you prime it first and then you plaster it? Well, there's where you get that word, I get plastered. You know, it's like I prime myself first. So I went out and, you know, I don't drink and drive. At least I thought I didn't until, you know, you stay around here long enough, God, more will be revealed. I used to drink, but sometimes I don't remember getting home. But, you know, I had a soda or two before I left that bar. I should have been sober enough to drive. That's what I thought. You know, well, I had a soda. I should be able to drive home. Don't remember getting there, but thank God I had, you know, I hadn't harmed anybody along the way. But it's just my story, you know. And I remember the two beers in the shower. And, of course, you know, I don't want to drink and drive. So guess what? My son had his learner's permit at that time. And I'm supposed to be this proud parent. Oh, my God. Here's the alcoholic thinking. You know, most mothers are, like, so proud of their children. I mean, this is an accomplishment in his life. You know, I'm like, he's like, Mom, you know, I was like, man, I was like, you got your driver's, like, you know, learner's permit. And he goes, yeah, you know, my thought, here's my alcoholic thinking. Now I won't have to drink and drive because he can take me and pick me up. And you want to know how alcoholism affects the whole family? Those were his same thoughts. He says, Mom, you won't have to drink and drive now. He says, I can take you and pick you up. You think alcoholism doesn't affect the whole family? We think we're only hurting ourselves? Do an 8th and 9th step. See how many people we hurt and we don't realize it. So, of course, you know, two beers in the shower. He takes me. You know, look, they said there had to be a licensed driver in the car with him. They didn't say they had to be coherent. Because when he picked me up that night, what a sight to see. What a sight to see, you know. So I ended up at this bar with most of my amends, and I'm not going to go, like, through the steps. I kind of go through them in the parts of my story as God brings it to mind. It comes out my mouth. So it's kind of like and I'm not going to go through the steps, but, you know, thank God for the 9th step amend, because when I showed up that night, you know, I was with most of my people on my amends were close. They were the family. Those are the ones that loved me the most. Those are the ones I did most the harm to. You know, I had acquaintances, you know, you have y'all, your bar buddies. Oh, yeah, you know, got the bar buddies, and I got sober. I haven't seen one of those buddies since I got sober, so apparently they weren't the friends I thought they were. They were just my drinking acquaintances, that's all. But I remember I get out there, and my first thought is, where's the keg? I didn't know this was going to be my last night, you know. I was like, where's the keg? And, you know, my niece is like, it's downstairs. And I didn't even say hi to nobody. It was almost like Moses, you know, parting the sea. It was just like, get these people out of my way. I need to get to the keg. And I went right for the keg. I mean, my nieces and everybody were like, hi, Aunt Doreen. I was like, where's the keg? So I headed and I sat down by the keg probably for about a good 15 minutes and just sucked down as many cups of beers as I could. So I could get sociable. You know, you got to loosen up. You know, that social lubricant they call in the big book, you know, I got to loosen up. Now I can talk to you. Because what do you say hi after hello? I had no social skills, you know, no social skills whatsoever. It's like, what do you say hi after hello? You know, if I met somebody like Casey, like, hi, Casey, you know, and what do you say? Keep me away from your husband, you know. It's like, yeah. And you might want to say, yeah. And you, I mean, that's what I'm going to tell. Honestly, if I want to take a fist out, like, keep me away from your husband. You never know. You know, once I get drunk, I black out. I end up in anybody's bedroom. It's like, I don't know. You know, not that it's intentional that I'm going to go there, you know, but even you probably might want to watch your animals, too, because, you know, I got little animals in my Hey, it's an honest program. And I am as sick as my secrets, but I see I have no secrets anymore, so I'm no longer sick. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. I can tell her story. She was sick. She was sick. But, you know, it's a gift. You know, and this is what the book describes, that we carry this with depth and weight. Because that is not who I am today. I can tell you her story all I want. I am not affected by her anymore. That is a gift. I can walk with my head up. I can walk with dignity and self-respect. But when I brought her to this room, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, she was a scared little girl. She was frightened. She was beaten beyond all existence. She didn't exist anymore. She wanted out. She wanted dead. And that's what I brought to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for God. And I remember that night, you know, I was standing in the middle, you know, I blacked out many a times that night. And I remember I woke up and I was standing in the middle of a dance floor and I was doing the electric slide in the opposite direction of everybody else. And, of course, they're doing it wrong. And then I remember I was standing in the middle of the city block and my sister-in-law was ahead of me. And I yelled for her to wait up for me. And she says, well, hurry up, because she had to use the bathroom. And so I took off running. And as I took off running, I hit this handicap ramp. And my face just bounced right across the asphalt. And my hands went out, and I just went down. And I remember my face hit hard. My hands didn't even come out. My knees were all busted. And I remember sitting up, and I was sitting on the ground, you know, in like Indian style, and I'm looking up, and all my family standing around me, and they're like, oh, my God, Doreen. And I remember I reached up, and I grabbed my face, and I come down with a handful of blood, and my sister-in-law looked at me, and she goes, oh, my God, Doreen, please don't touch your face. I said, Debbie, it can't be that bad. And I remember we got back to her house, and, you know, then the medical knowledge kicks in, clean the wounds, and my lip was kind of hanging off, so I shoved that back up into place and had a big abrasion on my jaw. And thank God I took my glasses off, you know. It was hot and sweaty August night, you know. And I remember I was sitting on the edge of her tub, and she kept saying, oh, my God, Doreen, please don't touch your face, you know, because I had gravel all in my mouth, and I had shaved one of my teeth. Had that repaired when I got remarried in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was kind of like shaved my tooth, and I'm sitting on the end of the tub, and she says, my God, Doreen, please don't touch your face. I said, Debbie, it can't be that bad. I believe God removes the pain when it's necessary. I didn't feel the impact of my face bouncing across that asphalt, but I felt the pain when I looked in that mirror. And she said, look. And that's what it was like. And that's what happened. And I looked in that mirror and I said to myself, my God, Doreen, what the hell have you done to yourself this time? I wasn't laughing anymore. It was no longer fun. I wanted out. And something inside of me stirred up and I got back to my house and I called that brother. My brother had 4 years prior to me coming in here. And I avoided him like the plague because I thought if I got next to him, his alcoholism might rub off on me. Like most people in AA, you know, they're afraid if they sit next to you, they might catch alcoholism. But I was like, I called him. And you know what scared me the most? If I'm not an alcoholic, why would I be frightened? Because when I hung that phone up, it was like all the blood drained out of my body. And I said to myself, oh, my God, Doreen, you just committed yourself to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that scared the hell out of me. Because you know why it scared me? Because I knew this was a not drinking program. Because I used to go to my brother's anniversaries with a hangover, but I showed up, you know. I respected what he did. I respected everything he did. I tried to avoid him as much as I possibly could. Because I didn't want to ruin his program. I didn't want to drink around him. Because I knew what he was doing. I knew what he was doing. I knew he was trying to better his life. But you know what? I called that man, and this is what we're taught to do. I don't know of any other way to put this, but my brother laid the sister aside and was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. He came over 4 o'clock in the morning, and he sat with me until his home group was that Sunday night, and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, Doreen, you got to get a sponsor. You need to do these steps. And women were giving me their numbers, and I was throwing them away because I'm not like you people yet. You know, I believe on August 9th of 98, I asked my brother for help. But it wasn't until 90 days later, I don't know exact. I don't have to get into the perfectionism of that. But I know on November 15th of 98, and I hung around these rooms for what I thought was 90 days. I was going to meetings. Women were giving me their numbers, and I'm throwing them away because I'm not like you people yet. See, I just thought it was not drinking. That's when alcoholism's at its best, when we're sober. And I was sober as I'm standing here tonight. I'm talking no mind, mood altering substance. I was as sober as I stand tonight. And I'm standing in my shower and I'm crying. God help me. I can't do this anymore. I can't keep going to these meetings and putting on my happy little AA face and acting like everything's okay, when I want to die inside and it's scaring me to death. And I want to drink so bad, but I know just 90 days later, I still see her face in the mirror, and I don't want to go down that path anymore. But I don't know how not to go down that path anymore. Because, see, it's just not sitting in these meetings. It's just not drinking. Something has to change. We have to have this profound psychic change, as the book describes it. Without that profound psychic change, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I'll do nothing but turn to a drink again, because that's the only solution I knew. And I didn't know it was a solution until I got here. See, I thought it was my problem. But now I see that it was my solution. Because if I didn't have that drink, who knows where I would have went. I thought about killing myself a couple times. I just heard this this lady or a tape the other day. It's like, you know, I don't think I really wanted to die. I just wanted to stop hurting. Oh, my God, I hurt so bad. And if death was the solution to that pain being gone, then that was my solution. But drinking got me here, you know. Thank God. Thank God the drink got me here. And thank God not drinking saved me and kept me here. Because, see, I was standing in that shower that night, and I'm crying, God, help me, I can't do this anymore. And I met this woman prior to that. And I remember I was probably about 2 or 3 weeks sober. And I remember I went to Harbor City because somebody was telling me this guy was speaking there for his anniversary. So I showed up. You know, I can fit in. I'm the chameleon sometimes. Even though it's painful, I'll try to impress you and act like I think I know what I'm talking about. You know, even when I'm new, you know, it's like I'm dying inside, but I want to impress you. It's like crazy. It's some crazy stuff, I'll tell you. So I went to that meeting, and there was a woman sitting on the front step. And I knew a face. See, God works even when we don't think He's working. I knew this woman. Now here, remember, prior to that, these women are giving me their numbers, and I'm throwing them away. Because I know what a fifth step's about. I ain't stupid. I know I got to share all my deep, dark secrets with another one of God's kids. We're not stupid people. I think we're smart. In a stupid way. But I knew in my heart I was going to have to. It was all, I mean, I had some, I don't even want to say religious background, but I knew confession had to do something with one of those steps, and I knew of confession, even though I never went to church and confessed. But I knew there was that had to do something with confession. And I was like, oh my God, I got to tell her all about these deep, dark, dark secrets, which I was going to take to my grave, you know. But the book says we have to tell at least one person our whole life story. I don't get to pick and choose what to tell her. Because when I keep something, it kills me. See, I think I'm hurting her. But if I keep something, it kills me. It doesn't kill her. She is unaffected by it. The book says that. I have to find someone who is unaffected by my history and pretty much has lived the same thing. So this woman, I knew her face. We grew up in the same neighborhood. Her family knew my family. It's like we went to the same schools. We crossed paths many a times in our drunkenness. You think God wasn't working in my life? You can't tell me that now as I look back in hindsight. Because that night that I stood in that shower crying at 90 days sober, and I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I started snapping at my kids again. You know, we'll heal up pretty quick physically. But it's the spiritual that kills us the most. Because see, physically, I was feeling good. I was going to meetings. I loved the fellowship. I was living off the fellowship for a little bit. I didn't even know that until now. I was sucking in y'all's spirituality and taking it home with me. Wasn't doing a thing with it. That's why I kept coming back, to get some more of your spirituality. I was sucking off of your life. I was sucking you out, you know. And then I take it home because I feel good after a meeting. And then that's why, you know, most people think that their day starts in the morning and ends at the night. For us alcoholics, it starts at 8 o'clock and ends 8 o'clock tomorrow night. And then we have to get some more the next day. You know, it's like we're backwards. We're nothing like the norms. It's like we start at night. Like after we leave here, all the information you get from this meeting tonight will carry you into the next meeting tomorrow night. But that'll only happen for so long. This is the fellowship. I love it. Don't ever want to not come to a meeting. I love the fellowship. I love sharing my experience, Strength of Hope. You can ask some of the girls I sponsor, because I think someday they'll sit there and yawn at me and I'm still talking. I'm like, I don't care. As long as God's using me, you're going to listen. I don't care. You can yawn 15 times in my face. I might be boring you to death, but I'm feeling good. It's like, let's go, God. Let's get them. They'll be like, they're like, what is she talking about? I have no clue what that girl's talking about. Then when they get it, I can't shut them up. So my sponsor passed the gift of gab on to me. Believe me, if most of you know my sponsor, I love her gab. She used to talk to me morning, noon, and night. Morning, and night, like, you know, all the time. But I needed that, you know, because I come in here not knowing anything, so I kind of absorbed it. You know, as she was saying it, I was absorbing it, and it was like coming around. And that night when I showed up at that meeting, well, guess who was standing there? Now, I hadn't seen that woman. I saw her that one time at that meeting when I was about 2 weeks sober. Now I'm talking, you know, a couple months later, and I'm going to meetings, and I hear this is, you know, sometimes we may want to be a little careful what we share from a podium, because I heard, this is what I heard, and I don't know if it's what they were saying, I'm just sharing my experience with you. I heard, go to as many meetings as you drank. Well, I didn't drink on Tuesday, so I started staying home on Tuesday. This is why we need sponsors. And I didn't go to meet. I really didn't drink that much on Thursday, so I started staying home on Thursdays. And then you wonder why I got restless, irritable, and discontent. Because I started backing off on meetings. Because, you know, my alcoholic thinking is going to say, well, you know, you don't really have to go to a meeting on Saturday. You really never drank that much on Saturday. I don't know how your alcoholic thinking talks to you, but that's how mine talks to me. Because that night when I was in that shower and I cried, help me, God, that's the only reason I'm standing here tonight. Because that's who I reached out in my level of desperation. I said, God, help me. I can't do this anymore. And I showed up at that meeting and there was a woman and two men from Baltimore sharing that meeting, and I knew her because I was like, oh my God, what are you doing here? And here's what she said to me. She says, I don't know. She said, because I just did this meeting 2 weeks ago. She says, and this is the first time I've ever done a meeting that close together in her sobriety. And she was 7 years sober when I met her. I know why now she was there that night, because they, you know, you'll hear the old timers saying, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And you know my sponsor, she's no nonsense. My sponsor is more concerned about your life than she is about your feelings. And she let me know that. And that's what we're here about. We're here about your life. This is a life-saving program. It's not a feeling-saving program. Because we are sensitive people when we get here. Don't hurt my feelings. I hurt my feelings. No. But so when I met her that night, I remember I went home and she talked about God like I'd never heard God. She talked about the 12 steps like I had never heard the 12 steps before. And she talked about sponsorship. And she said, because of those three things, and here was the turning point in my recovery. She said, because of those three things, she was a shell of a woman when she got here. And she said, because of those three things, that she stood comfortable in her own skin. How did I know she was comfortable in her own skin? She looked it. And I couldn't tell you how I knew that. But what the book, and what there is another book out, it talks about the language of the heart. See, my heart was open to the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if that woman wasn't there that night sharing that experience, that she laid all her other whatever aside to carry a message of hope, my heart was open to it. So we ain't worried about your heads. We're here to talk to your heart today. Because it's all about the heart. It's the language of the heart. And that's why I'm so compassionate and I feel so strong about Alcoholics Anonymous, because there are lives that need to be saved here. And we've got the gift to do that. We can't keep you sober. We don't get you drunk. But your life is here to be saved. Don't worry about all those other functions that take you out. That was light. That was pretty polite, wasn't it? Yeah. We just had a member about 3 days ago. And I know you guys and girls don't want to hear this, but we have a member that just committed suicide because he got caught up in a relationship and he couldn't stand the pain of losing her, so he overdosed. You think this thing ain't powerful? And I know you probably think we're full of crap, but that's how deep this thing goes. It just ain't about not drinking anymore. This is life. The men don't have it, girls, and the girls don't have it, men. The only thing that has it is God. God is the answer. The spiritual awakening that they talk about in the 12th step is building a relationship with a power greater than yourself. Because once you've entered the world of the Spirit in step 10, you've got to grow from there. And I know we got jobs and family, and I know we have, you know, spouses and children and things like that. But if anything, and this is what my sponsor said to me. She said, Doreen, put God in the 12 steps at the top of a list. And she said, everything you think you want or need, put below that list. She said, draw the line and put everything you think you want or, you know, need below that God in the 12 steps. She said, look at God in the 12 steps right there. Put them in bold letters. She says, now you can have everything below that list. Everything. The book says we can walk anywhere on God's green earth, free. What do you think Martin Luther King was talking about? Free at last. Free at last. Thank God. Thank God we're free at last. And it has nothing to do with the outside stuff. The freedom is the bondage of self. That I am no longer wrapped up in myself, that I can't see your pain. That is the fourth dimension of existence. I am above the problem. Alcoholism is no longer my problem. God is the solution. So I have found this power. That's why I am so adamant about expressing it. And if you ain't feeling good, it ain't God's fault. Because he says he insists on us being, and he insists on us enjoying life and being happy. If I'm not enjoying life and I'm not happy, I'm probably in the way somewhere, or I'm trying to rearrange things outside of myself, again, the third step, to suit me. Because whenever I'm in trouble, it's because I'm in the way. Third step, the 10th step, my sponsor told me, she said, here's how my sponsor broke the 10th step down to me. She said, mind your own business. I didn't realize how much I minded other people's business until I stopped trying to mind other people's business. Oh, my God, it was a frustrating process. Because I wanted to be in everybody's business. I wanted to get up in the gossip of AA, too, man. You know, I was, who's doing who? Who's going where? Who's doing what? Who's what? Yeah. Oh, God, the ego feeds off of that stuff. My ego did. Now people try to come to tell me some bad things about somebody. I'm like, why would you want to take from somebody's spirituality? Don't you want to enhance it? So if you got something bad about somebody, don't take them down. Build them up. That's what we're here. We're here to build each other up. We're here to enhance our spiritual conditioning, not take from people's spiritual conditioning. Don't worry about the gossip. It'll go away. You'll grow past it. If you ain't got something good to say about somebody, this is what my sponsor and the old timers told me. They said, if you can't help them, don't hurt them. Please don't hurt them. You got lives that you're messing with in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking real people's hearts, because we're all about the heart. See, God speaks to me in my heart. this is where my disease center is. This is the one I want to go telling everybody, oh, do you know what so-and-so did? Because it feeds off of this. But here, it's like, this don't feel good. Don't go around talking about other people. And I've done it. That's why I know what the experience is. I have the experience. I love the gossip in AA. Sometimes my mind says, like, go over there and find out who's that. What are they doing? But my feet go in the opposite direction because that's where my heart is in my feet. I was like, I don't want to know about it. Please don't tell me about it. Because I like to run with it sometimes. So, the 11th step, as I understand it today, has everything to do with my relationship between me and God. Because when that's solid, I don't care about what anybody else does. I don't care what anybody else thinks about me. Because I'm good.
I'm good.
You know that, what is that, Bruce Almighty? I'm good. I'm good. I love it. If you don't feel it, oh my God, you're missing it. You're missing it. Don't let your mind take you out where your heart wants to stay. Because this is it. This is it, man. It's the end of the road for us. You know, my one Joe sponsor used to always say, we all didn't come in here on the crest of the wave. We came in the undertow. You know, because that's what we do. I mean, it's like, come on now. We're listening to this guy on the CD up here. I love him. He's passed. And many of you might know him, Keith Lewis. Love Keith Lewis. He says when we get into the relationships, right? And so much on the relationships because our friend just passed, and my heart goes out to his family because of a relationship. He thought life had to end, you know. But he talks about it. He says it's kind of like, I mean, you got to remember who you're dating in the He talks about. He says it's like two ticks and no dog. They just suck the life out of each other. I mean, you got sick Jane trying to get involved with sick John, and then you got number sickness. That's all you're getting. You ain't got no recovery. You have no foundation. You have no God in your life, and you wonder why it ain't working. Because you're sick. That's why. get some God in the middle, and then you have something to share. Honestly, when you think about a relationship, ask yourself this one question. And I know, girls, the guys look good because I remember, you know, I came in here with a 21-year marriage and I knew the men didn't have it because I used enough of them before I got here. But that don't mean I wasn't looking because my sick thinking was still going, but my heart was like, yeah, that's going to work. It didn't work before. It ain't going to work now. But ask yourself one question. I'm going to end with this. Whenever you consider any type of action in your recovery, ask yourself this one question. Is it going to help me grow spiritually? Not hormonally. Thanks for letting me share.